is Robert Stark. I am joined here with a UC Davis professor, Daryl Hamamoto. Daryl, it is great talking to you.
Thank you for the invitation, Robert, to speak with you today. I'm sure your audience will get a lot out of this conversation.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Alex von Goldstein.
It's great to be on with you guys, and I'm very excited to talk to you, Daryl.
Same here.
So to start things off, I'm interested in talking about kind of how your views evolve. You teach Asian studies at UC Davis, and there's a lot of perceptions about ethnic studies in universities, their role in education and our culture. And you teach an ethnic studies class, but you have very unconventional views. Can you talk about yourself, how you got started teaching, and how your views have evolved over time from when you started teaching Asian studies to your views now?
I'd be glad to. Yes, I took my first course in Asian American studies at Cal State Long Beach in the early 70s from one of the pioneers of the field, Dr. Franklin Odo, who later went to become a high-level official within the Smithsonian Institution. And back then, ethnic studies, including Asian American studies, Black studies, as it was called then, and Chicano studies, and soon to follow women's studies, were innovative, cutting-edge, very exciting, robust fields. And I was really excited and glad to help be part of this movement. So decades later, right, we're talking about today, the second decade into the 21st century, and I had gone through the graduate school route and earned my doctorate in ethnic studies, comparative culture, because I firmly believe that this was an area within the social sciences and humanities and the arts and even in the sciences that was not being recognized within the university system to the detriment of the university and to the detriment of the professional staff and the students. And I mention this is because as of now, as I have found and discovered to learn the hard way, well, I came to the realization years ago, in truth, but now the administrations and colleagues within my own department, the chair, his name's Richard Kim. Before that, it was a guy named Nolan Zane. And before that, a woman named Wendy Ho. The deans, all these people, what I've had to finally acknowledge is that Asian American studies, ethnic studies, women's studies, all these formerly cutting-edge, revolutionary, if you will, forms of inquiry has been hijacked. It's been completely taken over. And there's many, many examples of this occurring. American literature was hijacked in the 1950s by the Iowa Writers' Workshop, as it turns out. All this great literary fiction, supposedly, that was appearing in the New Yorker and all these little magazines across the country were being sponsored indirectly through a series of front groups, cultural front groups, through the Central Intelligence Agency. This is revealed just a few years ago. And on the internet, you read all kinds of stuff almost incessantly. It's become a giant echo chamber about how the 60s were supposedly hijacked by the CIA. By the way, I don't believe that argument in total. A lot of individuals really dig the fact that the 60s were so corrupted and all that, but there was a lot that came out of it. Just like in the ethnic studies, women's studies I spoke of, there was incredible efflorescence of countercultural, counter-hegemonic forms of artistic and intellectual inquiry. Even in sports, you got someone like Bill Walton, or back then his name was Lou Alcindor, later became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. John Carlos and Tommy Smith, Olympic athletes, the Mexico City Olympiad. It was thoroughgoing, and the reason I mention this, gentlemen, is because all of this vitality and all these great inroads were being made, this is why the intelligence operations, the corporations and the military, with the cooperation of education institutions like the University of California, had to infiltrate all these endeavors and flip them on their head. And look where we are now, right?
I listened to a previous interview you did, and a lot of your views on your interest in Asian studies were based on the Asian American history and issues like the internment of Japanese Americans. But what really made your views started to change, you mentioned an experience where you were at some convention for Asian studies, and there were all these multinational corporations and foreign businessmen there sponsoring the event.
Oh, absolutely. You have Big Pharma sponsoring special editions of the AmerAsia Journal published in at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, which was one of the points of origin for the Asian American Studies movement. You have Big Pharma who funded a special issue in Asian American Health. And I submitted an essay, and it was about pimping out Asian American people to the hepatitis B vaccine makers. And you may not remember this, but in the late 70s and 1980s, the so-called AIDS-HIV epidemic was traced to the vaccination regimes of the gay populations of New York City, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, hepatitis B. So 20, 25 years later, they've targeted Asian American people to do that. And they were holding all these little cool shows at UC Davis on the campus, starring all little hip-hop dancers and the comedians and all the other cool people that the undergraduates can really admire and worship. And the same thing with UCLA. They hijacked the journal, and the article that I wrote about the hepatitis B vaccine that was being pimped out on Asian Americans, that was rejected. Fortunately, it was published in Memory Hole that was edited, or is edited, by James Tracy, Professor James Tracy, whose name might ring a bell because he was fired over the holidays, this recent holidays, from Florida Atlantic University for raising serious questions about media manipulation and false flag attacks and possible psychological deep intelligence operations taking place around the Sandy Hook shootings. So it's all happening right now. Tomorrow there's going to be supposedly a day of rage for the Republican convention, all of it orchestrated using both useful idiots and people at the higher level who are completely cognizant of what they're cooperating with.
Is this the summer of chaos, Daryl?
The summer of chaos is underway. I think it was kicked off recently with the cop killings in Dallas just last week, and it's all orchestrated.
So can you explain to us what summer of chaos is? I mean, I've heard it's connected to Jeray McKesson and Black Lives Matter. He had gotten his phone was hacked, and this has been revealed. So could you explain to our listeners the background behind this? Because I've only seen little fragments of this.
Sure. It's been known for months, and I think Alex Jones at InfoWars and his reporters and researchers and contacts revealed months ago that Black Lives Matter is funded by the Open Society, and the Open Society, the man behind that is the one and only Dr. George Soros. By the way, he's a PhD in economics. He got his PhD at the London School of Economics, which is, from what I understand, historically is connected to Tavistock. And when he names his foundation the Open Society, he's really talking about Marxist-Leninism. That's what he means by open. And in order to achieve a Leninist, Marxist, Maoist society, you have to level everything, the infrastructure, the industry, the educational institutions,
the culture,
the law enforcement
people,
departments, communications, media, level it all. We're going to start at year zero, just like they tried during the French Revolution with the Jacobins, right? This is what they want. This is their grid. This is their plan. It's a modern invention, but it's not new. We're seeing a new iteration, a new wrinkle that's beginning to unfold, as you observe. And just before I got on air here, I was watching YouTube because I canceled my cable TV subscription a long time ago.
Same here.
It's only good for internet and YouTube, really. I don't want to promote YouTube because you know where that's linked, right? But anyway, I was watching the reports on what's going on in Paris, right? In Paris,
the
home of
the
French Revolution.
Attack.
Yes, you heard about it.
Yeah, a truck just slammed into a bunch of people at the Bastille Day celebration.
There you go. Yeah, the Bastille, which was torn down and no longer exists physically, the Bastille, but now we have the electropharmaceutical Bastille that has the people in a fog of war. Except for the fact, gentlemen, that you, me, your listeners, and millions of people all over the world are coming out of the fog. That's the good news.
You wrote a book titled Asian Americans, Servitors of an Empire. And the concept
Correct.
Of servitors of an empire, it is a reference to a term in ancient Rome.
Correct.
I haven't read the book, but based on the reviews of it, the basic premise is that Asian immigrants are being sort of groomed to be used as pawns of the elites.
Exactly. In 25 words or less, you nailed it. Absolutely. And see, the irony is that I'm a senior professor in Asian American studies. I helped build the institution, the subdiscipline, that has grown phenomenally over the past three decades. And now I find myself in the position of being targeted by people in this area who have infiltrated and hijacked it, who want to push me out. See, that's part of their little dialectical scheme. So, yes, these people are the servitors of empire. They are the yellow people. They are the Orientals. They are the Asian Americans who cynically have exploited race and ethnicity in order to take control over the main institutions of American society, from government to the economy, business, corporations, academia, all the way down the line. So I guess you can say I'm no longer relevant to Asian American Studies 2.0, which is sellout Asian American Studies. They hate me because I'm blown their cover and I'm not allowing them to go free and try to get over on the American public. See what I'm saying? And you can apply the same process to Black Studies, to African American Studies, to Latina or Latina Studies, and they're calling it Latinx now because they don't want to make it gendered anymore. And women's studies, you name it, all the ethnic studies, all the vital, vibrant, cutting-edge types of disciplines that were insurgent back in the late 60s and 70s have been neutralized, have been conquered, have been exploited, just like the great American Republic has been conquered, exploited, and reversed and stood in. We're like the American Republic in microcosm. Yes, sir.
So, yeah, you started out on this kind of cutting-edge side of like thinking, and then you, with these other people, and then you saw them gradually just move into the establishment and still think that they were on the cutting edge.
Absolutely.
So how do you deal with that?
I don't live in the same kind of problem. Oh, you did? Well, tell me about your situation.
Just friends from college, being part of kind of like a music scene, and you know, you sort of have all these weird creative types, sort of freaks. And then these people eventually take on these politically correct terms, and then there's sort of this ideological superstructure that has consumed so many people I know who at once were like free thinking, completely free people, and I'm sort of seen as like this fascist now because throw that out.
And
the
they're
window.
Left. They're on the left. They're putatively progressive type people, right?
Exactly.
There's a great book. It's called Liberal Fascism by Jonah Goldberg. It's not that old. It's only a few years old. Recommended reading, which describes at length and in greater historical detail what you just summarized here. These are left authoritarians. These are liberal fascists. And I will use the F word, fascism. You can parse it any way you like. It is fascist. It's authoritarianism at minimum. And they're cool. Right, they're into indie music, they're into shoegazer music. Right, they know what the latest variety of coffee to drink for their lattes. Right, self-righteousness.
Yeah, they have
not even just like, oh yeah, we know we're cool, but there's a self-righteous element
there
that's
authority.
Dangerous. Yes, it's a moral superiority and furor that's not unlike what we're seeing amongst the jihadists. The summer of chaos, man, just wait till the jihadis start chiming in here and getting in on the action.
Can you talk about some of your personal experiences with censorship in the university system?
Absolutely. Within the last 2 weeks, I got a note from Mr. Dr. Richard Kim, who's the director of Asian American Studies at UC Davis, California, co-signed by the dean of my school. Her name is Professor Susan Kaiser, who's also in women's studies, another example of a professional who has used women's studies in order to enforce political orthodoxy, co-signed by the vice provost of Maureen Stanton, who built herself as an environmental ecologist, right? That's a pretty loaded phrase right there. And I assume it's signed off all the way to the top, the chancellors and all that. Anyway, I named these three people because they're officially the ones on the racks, and they're the ones who I'm going to be seeing in the courts, not in the UC Davis administrative law kangaroo courts that they've dragged through me for the last 2 years, but in a civilian court, a civil court, with a jury of my peers. And when they hear the stories in public that will be covered by the newspapers about what I've had to endure and suffer at the hands of these thugs, the public will be outraged, and the University of California will stand to lose millions and millions of dollars in addition to goodwill by the public. Because you know what? It's not about me, Daryl Y. Amamoto, PhD. There are scores of people, if not hundreds of people like me, who have suffered in the same way, including Dr. Peter Duesberg, who dared to question the so-called AIDS thesis at UC Berkeley. His grants dried up. His funding was taken away. He was consigned to a basement office. They couldn't fire him because he was tenured, but they shunned him and stigmatized him and ostracized him. By the way, his attorney is the same as mine, Mr. Dan Siegel of Oakland, California, prominent civil rights attorney. And then we have Dr. Ignacio Chapella, also from UC Berkeley, also in the sciences. I mentioned the sciences because those people in the sciences think that they're above the fray where it comes to political correctness and repercussions. No, you are not. In fact, you people in the sciences, IT, engineering, mathematics, you are the most vulnerable because you are standing in the way of billions of dollars of money that could go to the University of California, its stockbrokers, its Wall Street connections. You are standing in the way. I am nothing. I am doing nothing. My work is worth about maybe $1.95 to Wall Street. Trying to do is tell them, hey, man, you better wake up because you could wind up dead, if not have your career ruined. A lot of them just, they just get worn down. But as you can tell, I'm not worn down. I'm revved up. I'm wound up because I've researched this. I've gone deep. I've been able to exercise the full scope of my training and my discipline that I have cultivated for the past 30 years, and I brought them to bear in a very, very fine point, as sharp as a katana.
You see a major component of the corporate backing and a Wall Street backing for ethnic studies is support for mass immigration and the cheap labor. You obviously have the H-1B visas in the Silicon Valley, and a lot of this goes back to the Immigration Act of 65.
Absolutely. You know your history, and it was the Immigration Act of 1965 that reopened the doors to Asian immigration and immigration from the Middle East. I saw that as a positive force, but as we know, in the dialectical fashion, the powers that be, including the corporations, as you just alluded to, use something positive and turn it into a negative. And that's what we're seeing now with the, it's not even legal immigration they're talking about. I don't need to tell you this, but we have swarms of illegal immigration coming in regularly with full knowledge of the government, the military, and the corporate elite. You have that illegal immigration. Then you have the H-1B people, mostly from Asia, China, and India. And this is where those STEM people come in, the science, technology, and engineering, and mathematics. Your future, your jobs, your profession are going to be stolen from you by Bill Gates, right? Sergey Brin, the Google guys, the usual cast of characters, right, who want low, cheap, international, trained labor to come in. They don't even have to come to the United States. That will undermine this vibrant middle class that we have built assiduously through most of the post-war period.
What about Pierre Odemivier from PayPal? I think that's how you pronounce his name.
Who's that?
Yeah. Pierre Odemivier? I think that's how you pronounce his name.
Oh,
not
yeah. He's the,
sure.
the founder of it. He's where is he from? I don't know.
I'm
Russia?
Not sure. I think he's Persian.
Persian,
I'm not sure,
okay.
though. But I've seen him connected to a lot of strange things in the Ukraine. And I feel
yeah.
like we're reaching a point now where we have this corporate state emergence, and a lot of what I see happening is just different billionaires almost playing a game of chess with each other, like George
mm-hmm.
Soros.
Well, I'm surprised that they're willing to put themselves up in public like this, including Soros. So that tells me that there's people above them. They're the public face of larger, probably. Centuries-old families. A lot of them are of the Persian bloodlines, by the way.
I know George Soros, didn't he play a major role in crashing the economies of a lot of Asian countries?
And he was also responsible for busting the Bank of England. Some of these countries, I don't know about Asia, but in some of these countries, he's considered an outlaw. If he ever steps on their soil, he'll be arrested.
Oh, yeah,
yet
I think
he's allowed
Malaysia.
To run rampant in the United States and fund Black Lives Matter and you name it. I mean, I have a colleague. She still didn't receive money from Soros, but from another foundation. That's where this funding is coming from, ladies and gentlemen. It's the Mellon Foundation. These are oil people. And she managed to scam a program called, Critical Border Studies. And all that is, as you're alluding to, is to open all the borders so we can let illegal immigration and legal immigration just completely carve up what's left of the United States by overburdening the welfare system and undermining the tax base. So, yeah, they're funding in academia, and that's one of the reasons, again, to answer your earlier question, why I am a target, because I called them out. I've sussed it out. I figured it out. I've written about it. I speak about it. We're talking here. And tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have heard me talking about this, including people in academia. I have tons and tons of fellow professors, intellectuals, and scholars, not just the University of California, who agree with me, who I've been in contact with. They're too frightened to come forward. But once, all it takes is one or two people to do that. Once the situation gets bad enough and you have people like me who've set a precedent, the floodgates are open and it's over for these people who are pimping ethnic studies, women's studies, critical border studies. And ladies and gentlemen, I'll give you a little bit of a hint here. Anything new, quote unquote, that comes out of academia with the prefix critical on it, you know, whatever it is, critical food studies, critical travel studies, critical video game studies, it's bogus. It's just the opposite. It probably means authoritarian, fascist, techno-fascist, repression
yeah,
studies.
It seems like
so
critical theory is the weapon that these elites use.
That was where it started. You're absolutely right.
And that's why I'm into this guy.
So-called Frankfurt School. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I'm not sure. Are you familiar with Kurt Doolittle?
No, I'm not.
Oh, he's pretty interesting. He has this Propertarian Institute in the Ukraine, and he has this whole system. It's like this reboot of like 70s propertarianism, and it's about like when you're solving a problem using operationalism instead of instrumentalism. And
mm-hmm.
and I find that it's a really effective way to defeat critical theory arguments, because you essentially to say to the person, well, can you explain what you're saying in operational terms? Because
uh-huh.
they can't. It's only instrumental theory, just critical theory that these people use.
You know, I don't even know if we have to go that far and argue on their playing field, which is philosophy and casuistry. If you do that, you're going to lose. I just simplify it in saying, listen, you're basically communist socialists who were kicked out of the country because they didn't like your people of your religious background. So you came to America and you started psychology, social psychology. For example, Kurt Lewin, right? L-E-W-N, former of the Office of Strategic Services, OSS. So if you just point to these people historically and see what they've done and the consequences that,
yes.
that their work has had, all you have to do is point at, man, where is America now? I mean, look at Herbert Marcuse, who I
met,
by the way.
Exactly. He was CIA.
Yeah, they were OSS type. These are intelligence people. So the thing is that if you argue on strictly on their basis, and this is what's so confounding to my peers at I shouldn't call them peers because they're beneath me, but my colleagues, let's say, at UC, is that if you play on their field, you're going to lose every time because they got it locked up in a wrap. So I just do the monkey, the drunken fighting style, gung fu, you know?
You just take all their guys and explain who they are and how corrupt
that's
are?
That's right. Yeah, all you got to do is
stand
back and laugh at them. Pardon me?
What can you tell us about Marcuse? You said you met him.
Marcuse, yeah, he was in his golden years, about ready to pack it all in, but he was finishing out at UC San Diego. I think he was at Brandeis University for many, many years, but he was one of the pre-war intelligentsia that was brought in by probably intelligence and foundations like the Rockefellers and the Ford Foundation to the United States, expatriates. And when I read this stuff years and years ago, I said, oh, that's really great. It's really made a great contribution to American social science, political science, behavioral science, psychology, and all that. But subsequently, I learned that, again, it was a dialectic. Some of it was liberatory, like One-Dimensional Man, Herbert Marcuse, which was kind of like the Bible for the counterculture and the new left. I read that book when I was in graduate school and said, yeah, that's great. We're going to reform the institutions and throw off the shackles of sexual repression, and then we can reach our utopian world. But, of course, they didn't tell you that it would be a communist world. It would be a totalitarian world where all the contradictions, as they call it, would be overcome through some sort of Hegelian dialectical process where the state would be the ultimate expression of human imagination, creativity, and intelligence. Because it's Hegel. Hegel was a worshiper of the modern nation state, which is totalitarian. Yeah, so that's Marcuse. You know, totalitarianism coming from the left, it comes from the right, it comes from the middle. Let's not get our
direction.
And
they just wait for the Hegelian synthesis, right?
Exactly, which is the state.
Going back and forth and back and forth. What was that?
Mm-hmm. The ultimate expression of the dialect. This is what David Icke doesn't get. He talks about, you know, problem, reaction, and solution and all that, all these great formulas that you read about on YouTube. Or it's like a giant echo chamber. But if he read the material, if he had read the Phenomenology of Mind, and this is where just sort of half-big education really falls short. You know, I'm very critical of so-called professional intellectuals and the university and all that, but it does have some usefulness in that you have to read the material to understand it. But the very important point that all these people are missing is that the ultimate expression of the dialectic is the state, right, with a capital S, not the state of New Mexico or California or New York or Colorado, the state. And we could call that today the New World Order.
You've written about the topic of Asians in film and how they're portrayed in film. Can you talk about how sort of Hollywood's portrayal of Asians and Asian Americans?
Yeah, I wrote a book that was published in 1994 with the University of Minnesota Press. I'm fairly productive, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, just so you know that I'm not just some guy who miles off the university. I'm just telling you this because that's one area that they really can't zap me on. I've published so much and have written so much and made such a huge impact on a variety of fields that they can't do this. All they can do is nitpick me by saying that I triggered somebody. You know, they had a sort of a mental breakdown because I said something that they didn't want to hear. Anyway, I published a book in 1994. It's called Monitored Peril: Asian Americans on Television. And I went from the beginnings of television. That's why I know so much about media and how it works, the psychology, its institutional history. And I traced sort of decade by decade the different roles that Asian Americans have occupied through the, as it turns out, the intelligence military networks, ABC, CBS, NBC. They're all the same, as we know, right? So that came out. And the insights of what is that now, 20? 25 years ago, they still hold. That book's a classic. It's held very, very strong. And by the way, just before I got on the interview with you two gentlemen, I got an invitation from UC Berkeley. They want me to be on a panel discussion talking about this very topic, about Asian Americans in media. Now, as I've been saying for the past 20 years, and this holds true for anybody, any group, or any industry, I've been saying for all this time is that, hey, we don't need to break into the industry. We're not going to be there. It's who you know, right? And it's your network that's going to get you a job. I don't care what level of talent you're on. I mean, you could be a great writer like David Mamet, right? And even he's going to be shunted aside if he doesn't write the type of script that the Penguins, you know, the suits demand. You know, putting little ideological comments.
John Milius.
Yeah.
He made Red Dawn, and then he's done forever.
He made a really good movie, Conan the Barbarian, right? Which is based on Robert E. Howard. That was a great film. Anybody who is a libertarian or you know, conservative with a small C, gonna have problems in Hollywood. So, you know, why do you need that? We have alternative media now. You two gentlemen have a show. We're talking. People are listening. There's an audience out there. We don't need to go to the Golden Globes, do you? I don't need to be there. I don't need an award. I can't even get a merit. I can't
even
get a raise.
That's not what the zeitgeist is.
No, it's not. Give yourself a raise. Give yourself a promotion. Create an industry out of on your own. It's easier now than ever before. Man, I got an iMac sitting right in front of me. I got software. I got plugs in. I got a digital audio workstation. I can make my own music. I can lay down my own vehicles, vocals. I can put down my beats. I can play my instruments into this, and I could send it out there to, you know, to anybody who has a decent internet connection. We can do the same thing on radio. We can do the same thing on for video, you name it. Movies, I was watching Vimeo last night. I saw a great short movie by, I can't remember the director's name, but she had dramatized a short story by one of my favorite writers, Charles Bukowski, called The Woman on the Escalator. It was a short 5-minute piece, and man, it was better than most 90-minute Hollywood movies starring Julia Roberts and George Clooney.
Huh. Well, we can use the internet to basically make our own, like, we can, like, use, like, decentralization, and we don't need to reach the entire world. We can develop our own communities through the internet.
That's exactly
an amazing thing.
There's network concept is dead anyway. Everything's multiplex. It's more like, and some movie industry people told me a long time ago, they said it's going to be more like niches and sort of like the magazine concept, where people who are into motorcycles are going to be in this channel or in food in this and there, and that's really what's happened. You don't have to cast a wide net anymore. You can go drill in really deeply.
Can you talk about the pornographic film you directed a while back? It's called Skin on Skin, and starred Asian American actors, because the premise Japan produces a lot of porn, but in American porn it tends to be, your argument was that there was a lot of Asian actresses, but very few Asian male actors in porn.
Mm-hmm. Well, the gender balance there, of course, is to favor the majority group and say to the Asian male population, not just in the United States, but globally, which, by the way, is huge. It's like 1 out of 5 people in the world is Asian, right? That, hey, we're just going to exclude you out of our game. You know what? I got over that many, many years ago. I went to Asia myself and lived there. So that doesn't bother me. But anyway, just as sort of a gesture and as a joke, and it's just sort of a middle finger to academia and to Hollywood or to the adult business and to the news media in general, I just said, man, I'm going to make a movie with an all-Asian-American cast. It's going to be an erotic movie. And I also backed it up with an academic article that was published in an academic journal, New Political Science is the name of the journal. It was also later re-anthologized in one of the books I edited called Counter Visions. And the book was called The Joy Fuck Club, Prolegomena to Asian American Porno Practice. So I laid out the theoretical foundation. Ladies and gentlemen, in case you just think I'm a cheap shot artist here, I laid out a coherent, cogent argument on why this is necessary. And that's another reason why they hate me at the universities, because they said, damn, this guy made a skin flick. He's writing articles on it. He's getting all this play because it was reported by the Daily Show, you know, when Jon Stewart was a host. I was even in the monologue of the Tonight Show. Jay Leno picked it up. His writers read the news feed that day and said, there's a professor at UC Davis who said, you know the whole story, right? So I got huge play. And, gentlemen, this is part of my strategy. You see, I'm not going to rely on, 20 people in my subfield to make me feel good about what I do. I don't care, right? I want to get my message out to the larger public. This is what's called being a public intellectual. This is what writers used to be. They didn't all work for some university in some department writing for one another, these obscure, arcane, and you guys have been to college. You've read some of these articles, right? Most of them are incomprehensible gibberish that are inconsequential. I want to reach the people. That's what education's about. So I use the media. I study it. I said, what's going to get me over? Yeah, I'm going to make a skin flick. Everybody's going to cover that. And sure enough, that's what happened. Now, if you think this was just a flash in the pan, right, just a one-off, that it had no meaning other than what took place sensationistically 2004, well, let me tell you this. There's a guy, he goes by the name of Jeremy Long. That's his skin screen name. And I think he has a website called Asian Man Schlong or something. I don't know what it's called. But he is a Asian American erotic actor. And guess what? Ladies and gentlemen, he's a graduate of the prestigious University of California, Berkeley. And after he finished his undergraduate work there, he went to University of California Law School, right? It used to be called Bold Hall. Now it's just University of California Law School. So I think he's graduating pretty soon. So guess what? He name-checked me in an interview saying, wow, yeah, I was in an Asian American studies course, and I read this essay by this guy named Daryl Hamamoto who said that we need an Asian American porno practice. And he was inspired by that. So ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that ideas work. They do have consequence, long-term consequence. And all the people here who are going in on me, who think they're putting me out, guess what? My ideas are already out there, and you can never squelch them. You will never kill them. Truth is irrepressible. And I'm sorry I'm talking like, you know, Muhammad Ali, but, you know, he just died recently. We got to remember the man that he was at the peak of his game before they tried to take him down. It didn't happen. They throw him into prison. During his athletic prime, he came out and reclaimed the championship multiple times and became a hero for all times, far transcending the little world of boxing, just as I transcend the little world of the University of California. Do you hear that, Janet Napolitano? Do you hear that, Linda Cadehi? Do you hear that, Susan Kaiser? Do you hear that, Richard Kim? I'm sorry, I'm going off.
Well, Muhammad Ali is interesting.
Hey, you know, by the way, most people are not used to hearing little Oriental yellow people like me talking like this. You dig? So that's another reason why they hate me, because they're used to coolies. They're used to people bending over and say, yeah, come on, Uncle Ben Cartwright, come on, little Joe, have your way with Hop Singh on the Ponderosa. They're used to George Takei. That's what they want. But I'm not that.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that the other day, and you have, you know, these people who are kind of brainwashed by political correctness, and then they hear someone who is like a minority or a person of color or whatever, and they're not going along with the script. I mean, if a white person who is completely brainwashed hears an Asian person tell them, you know, deprogram them, it just instantly, they're instantly deprogrammed. Because part of the programming is they have to listen to what, like,
that's
that
why
what people
that's
are
why
important. And, yeah.
That's why I'm styling out for you today, ladies. I'll help you put this on YouTube. I want you to send it all over the MF world. Because the yellow man, at least this yellow man, this Oriental, you cannot keep him down. You dig? All right. I'm sorry. I'm going off on myself again. I'm ego tripping. I guess only if you're a hip-hop or rap person. If you're a black person, it's okay to do that. But, you know, any other group, you're not supposed to be proud of who you are.
Well, if you're from the 60s, you can do that, though.
Only if you're Billy Boy Ayers, who's a trust fund baby.
Well, I heard
daddy.
He wrote Obama's book, Dreams of
There's been forensic analysis, and you know the story about Obama's real daddy, do you not?
Oh, Frank Marshall Davis?
Yeah, exactly. Joel Gilbert did the documentary on it, and it's convincing enough for me. And he has ruined the country. So, yeah, Billy Boy Ayers and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, the little 60s retreads. At the same time, you have all these ass clowns on YouTube talking about, Laurel Canyon was so corrupt. Yeah, it was full of David Cosby and Stephen Stills. You know, they had voices like angels that can play their asses off and were consummate musicians. But, no, let's focus on them. When
but
we should be talking about Billy Boy Ayers. What's that?
Weren't all those guys like, you know, David Crosby? They were all from like military families, though. I mean, I love that music, but
I think that whole argument had
some like goes into keyboardist CIA. I mean, that's the problem with for me and a lot of my friends is when we've gotten onto this kind of conspiratorial angle and having to look at all this sort of music and art that we like, and we're like, oh shit, is this stuff not good for us? Yeah.
It is good for you. I'm here to tell you, because I was a teenager, 14, 15 years old, when The Doors came out, and I want to tell you, The Doors are good for your health, your emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. Cosby, Stills, and Nash are good for your health. Frank Zappa is good for your health. Joni Mitchell, the Mamas and the Papas, the Beach Boys. Paul McCartney is not dead. He's very much alive. Who are these psyop people putting all this crap out on the 60s? Let's get over it. Stop using YouTube as an echo chamber. I had some trolls coming on my Facebook site promoting all that garbage, and I conveniently just kind of said, oh, I'm sorry. You're not going to use me as a forum for your deluded arguments. I don't know who you work for. I don't care. But you know what? I'm not going to let you tell me that Jim Moore Morrison was not a great American poet. He was one of the best that America has ever produced. Pardon me?
Like break on through to the other side.
Oh my God.
We can reappropriate that now because we're trying.
Yeah.
It's like they think that the other side has been broken into and that we live in this liberated world. But it's just an upside down version of like the past, state of oppression,
exactly.
Basically. So it's like we're just telling them to really break on through to the other side. So we're going to reappropriate 60s things, I think.
Jim Morrison was a very well-read, literate individual. He was painfully shy. He wasn't the Jim Morrison that we came to know and love as a performer. He was an intellectual. Let's not flog him because his dad was an admiral of the ship in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. My dad was in the military. Everybody's dad was in the military during World War II. All the kids, we thought it was normal. Everybody's dad was a veteran. We might not have been generals or sons of generals or admirals, but everybody went through that. So
my grandfathers are both World War II veterans.
Yeah, there you
go. Most of the kids I know around here, grandpa's born in World War II. So.
Exactly. Everybody went, and they were glad to go. My dad, he didn't like it, but that was the signal moment in his entire life or the rest of his life as a young man. So there's something, Diva, I'm glad we're going into this because it's something that's really been eating away at me. But this whole attack, and it's affecting young people who don't really know what the meaning and the significance and the importance of the 1960s. They only get a simulation. They think these social justice warriors are reflections of the civil rights movement of the 1960s counterculture. They're not. And I think that's one of the reasons why these people are coming out with books that are trying to undermine the artistry of all these great groups that came out of the 1960s. And not just in the rock area, not just in folk rock or pop music, but also in the world of jazz. Okay, Miles Davis. You know who got the
bird?
He
beat his wife or something.
Most people who write about music, unless you're in the jazz world, don't even talk about Miles. They want to focus on just a certain handful of groups. You know, the Beatles, the Bird, whoever came out of Laurel Canyon or L.A. But what about the ones that came out of Muscle Shoals, Alabama, who came out of Stax? You know, the Watt Stax Combine, or the Sound of Philadelphia. It wasn't just all L.A., it wasn't just New York, or Motown. Hey, how about Marvin Gaye? Was he an MK Ultra, Monarch Mind Control being? No, he's the guy that introduced the term ecology to popular music. Mercy, mercy me, the ecology. I mean, he said, what's going on, America? What's going on? So you see, that whole erasure of the 1960s is part of a larger psyop so that young people of your generation will watch tomorrow's madhouse and say, oh, yeah, it's just like 1968, the days of rage in Chicago, right? You know, a lot of that was legitimate, a lot of that was control. It's a pseudo second. As Marx himself said, the first time it's tragedy, the second time it's farce. And what you're about to see tomorrow is a farce.
What tomorrow?
Well, that's supposed to be the day of rage for the opening of the beginning of the convention.
Do you have any info on what you think's going to happen?
Don't have any info, but I suspect that a lot of these controlled organizations, we've already named one of the Open Society, but probably the Southern Law Poverty Center and ADL, you name it, are going to be there in droves using the social justice idiots that are going to fly in or being bussed in, and they're going to be controlled by organized labor, the United Auto Workers, the usual suspects, all these different nonprofits. In California, state capital, there was a demonstration that was mounted by some group out of Oakland, California, called By Any Means Necessary. You like that phrase? That comes out of Malcolm X. So they pimped out Malcolm X himself, who was an authentic, organic intellectual and revolutionary. And, of course, he got killed because he was for real. So you have, you know, memory pimps who take his phrase, by any means necessary, and they stage a demo here at the state of California Capitol.
Yeah, that's
they
what
come
I,
out
I don't
of Oakland,
understand.
Oakland, California.
I want to get your thoughts on Yoshio Mishima, because you were telling me in an earlier conversation that you're working on a chapter on him. He was a Japanese actor and writer.
Yes, he was a playwright, poet, you name it. He was the master of all kinds of media. For your audience who might not know who he is, and I really, really suggest that you look at least a little bit into his background, because he's an important historical figure on the world stage culturally, and a lot of his work has been translated into the English language. I've read most of it, I believe, including the monumental quadrilogy, The Sea of Tranquility. I read those books. I bought them all once. I found them on a table when there were bookstores still around, and they were on sale for 95 cents a piece. So I bought the whole deal, and I slogged through them all. Let me tell you first how I became acquainted with Yukio Mishima, and it harkens back to an earlier theme in our discussion here, and that is the role of Asian and Asian American people in media and the public society in the United States of America. Well, when I was a teenager, we didn't see many people except for Hop Singh and Jack Sue and all these sidekicks, and even the Green Hornets, Kato, was masked, right? And that was Bruce Lee, by the way. So we didn't have very much. So when I read about Yukio Mishima in Life magazine, and for the younger listeners, Life magazine was a monthly sort of a pictorial publication. The magazine was mostly pictures and text. And there was a feature article about Mishima Yukio, who committed seppuku, which is a ritual suicide in Japan. This is back in November of 1970. And there were all these riveting portraits and pictures and photographs of him, including him in his glistening, well-muscled body, carrying a katana, which is the Japanese sword, the samurai sword, as you would call it, just standing there, you know, addressing the camera and the world in the most militant and warlike and assertive position possible. So I clipped that out. I put it on my bulletin board, and I kept it up there for a few years, and that was what really got me into his literature and into his thought, because he also wrote essays, including the very important one called Hagakure, which is an adaptation of traditional texts written by literary men who were also warriors. Samurai class at a certain point became known not just for martial skills and administrative skills, but also for literary talent, literary music, poetry, all that out. That became part of what is necessary to become a truly accomplished warrior in a certain period of Japanese society. And when I say certain period, what Mishima was protesting against was this industrial capitalist modernity that Japan had been turned into as an arm of the United States and Great Britain, and to a certain extent the Soviet Union later on. What did Japan had been turned to after the defeat of Taiheiyo Senso, which is what Japanese call the Pacific War. We call it World War II. They call it the Great Pacific War. And he was saying, listen, we've lost our values, and this is what he wrote in Hagakure, and he was on television quite a bit, interviewed. He was a public figure, very much admired all across the board. He's been incorrectly characterized by his biographers like John Nathan and Henry Scott Stokes, I think his name is. I read both of these bios very early on. They were the first two ones that came out. One was an Englishman, one was an American, John Nathan. They caricatured him as a right-wing extremist, right? Just like anybody who's a conservative in America is considered to be a redneck or something, right? So they portrayed him that. But he was from samurai stock. I mean, he was a descendant of Tokugawa Ieyasu, who was one of the earlier shoguns of this great efflorescence of Japanese culture called the Tokugawa Jidai era, Edo Jidai, which is what most people recognize as being quote-unquote Japanese culture. It's really Tokugawa culture. And he's a descendant from that family, and on both his maternal and his paternal sides, he has those bloodlines. And then here he is, post-war period, and moving into the late 50s and 60s, and you could see Japan already becoming consumed by what today is the Pokemon culture. Now, there was no Pokemon, and we're going to get into video games because this is your guys' world, right? I want to learn from you some information about that. But he could foresee where we were going with the cheap cars and the ghetto blasters. And, by the way, rap and hip-hop, you know, all due respect to my African-American friends and family, all right? Rap and hip-hop would not be possible if it weren't for your Japanese cousins over there supplying you all these cool technologies, all them samplers, all them keyboards, all them recorders, all them turntables. That comes from the Asian world, brother. So hip-hop is very much a yellow thing. Just remember that, recognize and respect, all right?
On the topic of Japanese modernity, or the transition to modernity, do you know Sasaki Natsume's novel, And Then?
Of course. Everybody in elementary Japanese literature course has to read Soseki, right?
Yeah,
Kokoro
Naomi
and all that.
Some class in college, some like...
Of course, you have to go through, I'm not putting that down, you have to go through that, but that's part of the standard curriculum. And he was trying, because, you know, the reason why they use Soseki is because he was so dramatically torn between so-called West and East. But isn't that kind of like a cliche? We've learned, at least this was one of the benefits of postmodern theory and post-structuralism, is that these notions of modernity are much more nuanced than what we have learned. I mean, you got jihadis, and what are they? Man, they are like in Toyota pickup trucks.
Have you heard their music?
Gals.
ISIS has that song with all the auto tune, and it actually sounds kind of good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they download stuff just like you and me from the internet. So modernity, it's like a, you know, it's more like a little mosaic or bricolage.
We move into archaeo futurism.
Pardon
me? We move into almost an archaeo futurism, where the events of the past repeat themselves. The events of the past repeat themselves with modern technology.
Yeah, including, dirty bombs, possibly. Who knows? You know, they've got the drone technology and the missile technology. I wonder how far they're going to take it. You know, time will tell. I mean, it's kind of a throwback running a truck through all those innocent victims in Perry. You know, who knows where they're going to take it from there, though.
Back kind of on the topic of education, have you read Ron Enz's essay, The Myth of an American Meritocracy?
That sounds familiar. Who wrote that?
Ron Enz.
I'm not sure. I can kind of tell by the title itself. It's
yeah,
a myth, and it's
it.
Not a myth. You know, it's like it's not either a myth or a non-myth. I know lots of people, and I myself am an example of a meritocracy, I guess. You know, my parents on both sides come from dirt, although my dad did have a college education, and I supposedly rose to the upper levels of public, you know, university education, University of California, you know, big deal, right? So, and that can't happen. I mean, you know, like Mishima, right, he came from a good family. He went to Toda, University of Tokyo. There's somewhat of a meritocracy there. They're, you know, through the post-war bureaucracy. But, and, yeah, the Bushes have had it easy. But in America, there's still, you know, a pretty good deal of wiggle room for people. Wanted, if you want a caliphate, probably not. You know, it's going it's going to be stagnant. You're going to be stuck in your little caste or village that you were born in. But American meritocracy, I don't know. I can't see either way if it's a myth or not. But it works for a lot of people, I'll tell you, including Asian Americans. I see it all the time. That's what they're hoping for, anyway.
As far as future trends go, do you see Asians ending up becoming the elite of America, or do you see them forming more as kind of a buffer zone between the white middle class and white elite?
Well, I think for the time being, they're going to be sort of the buffer zone. You're going to see probably more marriage. They're going to merge through marriage, through intermarriage with the elites, the traditional hereditary bloodlines, right, of the Northeastern establishment. You're already seeing some of that. A lot of it happens in the universities, elite universities. You got a, let's say, an Amy Chua, who's the son of a prominent scientist who's married to, you know, gets married to someone that she's set up with at Yale University Law
Zuckerberg
School.
Zuckerberg has
like
a
that.
Chinese wife.
There you go. They met at Harvard University. They're being blended, hooked up, and intermarried at the elite schools. Right. Yeah. Good call. Her name. She's a pediatrician. Priscilla Chan is her name.
Aren't they like?
By
a,
the way, there's an example of a meritocracy. Priscilla Chan comes from dirt herself. I think her father runs a Vietnamese restaurant in Queens. Okay, but she got some kind of scholarship, and she's probably smart as a whip, and she got over to Harvard, and then she got to meet Zuck. And now she gets to live with him in a giant compound, and they're buying all their neighbors' homes, tearing them down so they can have a giant buffer zone around their castle.
And he can be the next George Soros.
Exactly. He's already putting his money into destroying America and the rest of the world, so.
He gets to build a wall around his compound in Hawaii, but we can't have a wall on our border.
That's right. He's built a wall in cyberspace for us to entrap us. But you know what? We're smarter than him. There's all kinds of young people who are much more savvy than him. I don't think Mark Zuckerberg ever invented anything, did he? I mean, even that movie, Social Network, he stole all that stuff, right? So we got all kinds of young
people. Yeah, he's not an inventive thinker.
No.
Yeah.
Believe me, gentlemen. We're going to come at them at an angle, and then they're going to say, man, we thought we had it all wrapped up. But all these young bucks came up, and they took it away from us.
There's sort of a concept of Asian-American identity, but I think that's sort of an American concept. I mean, throughout Asian history, different nations were at war with each other. Within the United States, there's some degree of conflict between different Asian groups. I was reading on a blog that a lot of in the Silicon Valley, a lot of Japanese-American programmers were saying they were discriminated against by Chinese or Indian-run firms.
Oh, absolutely. You've got Mike Hondo, who's an elected official there, Norm Mineta. He was run, basically, by the new post-65, post-immigration act, Chinese-American, Taiwanese-American community. Without their support, they would be nowhere. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, Japanese-American, which I am one, Okinawan Japanese-American, have been, you know, buggered pretty consistently for the past 60 years. They should be used to it by now. Well, do they do anything? No. You know, so, you know what? I'm not even interested in their identity issue. They're so lame. Instead of going on the blog, why don't they do something? Why don't they try to recreate or reinvigorate Japanese-American community? You know, instead of having it stolen from them in the San Francisco, Japantown, San Jose, Japantown, or Los Angeles, Japantown. Right, all that's been taken away.
I think, like, Little Tokyo in L.A., I think it's now mostly Korean.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they've got Little Tokyo Towers, which was a retirement home for Japanese Americans, mostly Korean or Chinese. So yeah, and the Japanese American community just said, "Hey, pardon me."
Oh, doesn't critical race theory almost destroy the individual ethnicities that exist in larger races?
Absolutely.
Because it's basically like you have this oppression matrix of whites and everyone else, but it's bullshit because, you know, there's a million different kinds of white people and there's a million different kinds of everyone else. So
exactly. It just it's reductionist and it's homogenous. And I abandoned that a long time ago, and again, that's why I'm having problems. By the way, talking about discrimination against Japanese Americans, I feel those people down in Silicon Valley. I don't want to. I'm the only Japanese American in my community, in my department, and I'm always getting flack from people. They think I'm obsolete, that they are the new Asian America that I represent, and they're tired of hearing about the internment. You know, they're tired about hearing Japanese American history. They're tired about the pre-1965 hardships, and to a certain extent, I am too, because what are we doing with that historical knowledge? Nothing. I'm talking about Japanese Americans. So, yeah, critical race theory, that's a bust. And, you know, so they have a critical race theory down at UC Riverside, University of Riverside. It's headed by some guy who's from the Philippines whose father was an official in the World Bank. And there's a woman there who's affiliated with them who does – I mean, her father was an ambassador of Singapore. You understand? These are elite Asian transnationals who are now fronting as racially oppressed Asian Americans.
Obama went to school in Singapore.
What's that?
Obama went to school in Singapore.
I thought that was Indonesia.
Oh, never mind. Oh, okay, cut that out.
Yeah, he's Madrasa trained.
Sorry.
Yeah, he can rock the Arabic. But he's part of an elite bloodline himself, Obama.
In what side?
He was bred from the Dunham side. He's like a third generation intelligence asset through his father and his mother, and who was quote unquote an anthropologist in Indonesia, right? That's Stanley Ann Dunham, and then he's the third guy. Yeah, he was picked at a very early stage. He was groomed. I mean, there are anecdotes about him walking around the neighborhood to strangers and some, I'm going to be president of the United States. You know, I mean, a lot of kids think that or say that, but in his case, I think he already had some inside information on where he was going to wind up. So yeah, we have to create new models. You know, and I don't say that I have the full rollout prototype ready right now as far as new models. We do have to get away from the old stale ethnic studies, women's studies, the critical race studies, the open border stuff, you know, sin fronteras, la raza, black power, and all, you know, all that stuff's going to have to be radically rethought, and that makes opportunities for the young intellectuals coming up to come up with something more real and effective organizationally, politically, as well as intellectually. We're going to do the new movies and culture and music, so we're going to do that. We don't have to listen to who is it? Give up all your guns. Who are some of these clowns out there? You know, your Bonos and all these
Seth Rogen and Amy Schumer.
Yeah, all those guys. They're irrelevant.
I think they know they are.
Do you think that ethnic studies should be abolished, or do you think it should be reformed?
I don't know if it can be reformed. It's just going to die on its own, so the question's really it's moot at this point. The university has gotten what they needed out of it, which is to flip it on its head and pimp out a bunch of students. So they're just going to let it wither on the vine.
Oh, it's
I'm
like what
lucky.
They did to the Native Americans.
Exactly. Just throw them on a reservation.
Radicalize them, too.
Yeah,
like, marxize some of them and make them, you know, just talk in total Marxist terms. Because they were like, you had so many different tribes that were all fighting with one another. And then suddenly they're all the same thing once, you know, time changes.
And then they'll throw you a little bone telling how noble your people were, and they'll make some movies about you, you know, like Running with Wolves or whatever. But you're in the same or worse squalid position as ever. So I'm going to resist ghettoization. I've broken out of the ghetto of ethnic studies, Asian American studies, of the university, and I'm opening up my game to the universe. You dig? And that's what I recommend for everybody within earshot. Open your game up to the universe. Write that down.
Well, Daryl Hamamoto, it is a been an excellent show. I want to thank you so much for being on. Before I wrap things up, do you want to inform our audience on any upcoming projects?
In October, if you're up at the University of California, Berkeley, I'll be on a panel talking about media. I'm going to be producing and composing and performing music, both live and recorded. I'm going to be making some movies and putting little stuff on YouTube. I have a channel on YouTube called Professor Hamamoto. Please subscribe. I got a Facebook, so you can check me out on that. And if they ever, they, meaning the University of California, Davis, including my director, Professor Richard Kim, if they ever allow me back in class, if you go to UC Davis, please take one of my classes. They were one of the most popularly well-attended classes in not only in my department, but the university. I used to routinely get 200 students in my introductory class. It was a rite of passage to study with Professor Hamamoto at UC Davis. So that's what made me so dangerous. So I'm taking my game, open up my game to the universe.
Professor Hamamoto, thanks for being on, and also thanks, Alex von Goldstein.
It's been a pleasure,
yes.
Guys. Thanks so
Thank
much.
Thank you both, gentlemen. Yes, I appreciate the opportunity to address your audience. And let me know if I can help you, because I'm doing this for the up-and-coming generation, right? I'm an educator, and I really, really believe in the generativity of youth and the education, the culture. That's why I got into the field. And no matter what the University of California does to me, that doesn't stop me in that area. I don't need them. I can still do my job. This is my calling. This is my mission. And I'm glad to share this very, very rapid, quick hour that we just spent together. Thank you very much for inviting me onto your show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
All right. Bye.